Welcome to the For Money Audio Commentary. This is David For on Friday, the 7th of March, recording at 9:16 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Still have the raspy voice, I'm afraid, but that won't stop me from soldiering on. Now, this being Friday, this is the big picture long-term outlook for the various asset classes. But first, let's have a quick look at the week in terms of highlights. For stock markets, it was a bit grim, mostly on the downside. Even the strongest of the strong, those have been resources plays, have hesitated near or beneath former highs. And many other stock markets are testing their lows, including just about all of Europe, some of the Asian markets such as Japan, the Hong Kong Hang Seng Index, and did I mention Europe? All the European indices, US and the main US indices such as the Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ, testing those January intraday lows. And we have some And since there are very good bounces from those January intraday lows, we have some new closing lows, which won't look good on the point and figure charts, of course. Okay, what else is a highlight? And I should mention that this was being led down by the financials, because the U.S. financial indices that I've been following have been touching new reaction lows. Okay. Now, what about long-dated government bonds? Pretty strong performance. That's the flight or fright to quality. The least strong are the U.S. Treasuries. A lot of supply out there. And in terms of currencies, well, the story really is dollar weakness. And the dollar has been falling practically every day for a month. And during that month, when it had an up day, it was a minimal upward day. Hit a new low today, but closed off the low. And, for instance, got down to 72.46. That's a new all-time historical low for the U.S. dollar index. Closed at 73.04. And therefore, we had a number of new highs for currencies. So some of the resources currencies took a breather. Asian currencies were strong, including the yen, that indicated some unraveling, further unraveling of carry trades and a general deleveraging process that has been occurring. The euro and the Swissy starred in here this week. Now, commodities have been the hottest game in town, and that goes on really since January, and they were doing pretty well before January. So this has been just a barnstorming advance here, but it began to unravel from those overstretched conditions this week. And we've had a number of weekly key reversals on some of those high-flying, accelerating trends. Remember I wrote a piece, was it 2 days ago? Yes. Just saying be wary in here. So many of these trends have accelerated. Acceleration is always an ending of an unknown time, of an unknown duration. But it's unsustainable beyond the short term, so always an ending. More on that in a moment. The oil had hit new highs in here as well. Okay, so were there any commodities that weren't performing? Yes, lumber is still relatively soft, although it's up in here. It's been up the last couple of days, and the livestock contracts, thinking now of lean hogs, live cattle, these have been underperforming considerably, and that's generated a fair amount of interest among the subscriber base. Okay, so let's go back to these stock markets now, and what on earth is going on here? Well, it will not surprise you to hear me say that the overall sentiment is extremely bearish. Extremely bearish. Why? Of course, because markets are pressing on those lows, and we are recipients of a daily bombardment of financial credit crunch concerns. And that is weighing on sentiment. And markets have also had to contend with runaway commodity prices and the inevitability of commodity price inflation, and that has concerned them. Runaway oil price, and how many of those, particularly academic forecasters, not that I have anything against academics, but you can remember, well, I remember, digress here, but I remember giving a speech back in back in the autumn. I think it was in October at Merrill Lynch, no less, in their spectacular conference center in the city of London. And here, someone forecasting $45 a barrel for oil. Well, we saw crude, as you know, push up over $106, got up to $106.54 here today, last $105.60. And natural gas has been running on the upside, pushed up above $10 today, but backed off that. So we've had, we've seen all this, lots for the markets, stock markets to contend with, and it has added to the overall bearish sentiment. Well, what about this credit crunch here? I mentioned that we're bombarded almost daily with new concerns, and this is, and I've already mentioned the effect on sentiment and the causing this flight to or fright to quality. But let's think what happens in here. What are the banks actually trying to do? First, they need to recapitalize, so they don't want to lend. They don't really want to lend to anybody except the U.S. government. And so what they want to do is to get in capital, and the sovereign wealth funds have helped considerably in that department. And these banks want to borrow short from the Fed, and they want to lend long in the government in the government long-dated bond market, playing the yield curve, and recapitalize on that process. So they've kind of put themselves into intensive care, recapitalizing banks through the yield curve has been the standard policy following every banking crisis that I've certainly seen over the last 4 decades and more. It takes time, but it does work. And so that's what they've been doing. So who's affected by that? Well, a private individual who wants to get a credit card or maintain a credit card, but who does not have a respectable deposit account with that bank, may find it's quite difficult to get approval for that credit card. Or the loan that they were hoping to take out is no longer available, or the teaser mortgage is no longer available. And Northern Rock, famously, with those 125% mortgages, these are no longer available. And good quality companies that want to borrow in the bond market, they find that rates have gone up a lot despite the Fed pumping in a lot of liquidity. Why? Because the banks don't want to lend to them. They don't want to underwrite these issues. They don't want to get stuck with a lot of bonds that they, corporate bonds, that they fear they won't be able to offload. There have been horrific stories about the potential for default in the corporate bond market, as you know. So, AAA rated borrowers, corporate borrowers, and a rating that's justified, unlike the derivatives ratings that were farcical. These borrowers are finding that they're having to pay more money in terms of interest rates. So anybody, basically anybody who needs to borrow is inconvenienced, to put it mildly. Now, let's talk about the rest of the world. Any organization, whether it's in the United States or anywhere else, that is cash generative, that has an international market, that doesn't need to borrow any money, those businesses are doing fine. And fortunately, Fuller Money is among businesses in that position. So cash generative, global client base, and no need whatsoever to buy. Business is tripping along very, very nicely for companies in that position. And this includes a lot of these big US multinational corporations. And also, I feel that so much of the analysis that we see, understandably, people are going to be obsessed with a credit crisis, a credit crunch, I should call it, and are going to focus on this. But you know, it's not global. It's, yes, it's hit Europe's fanned out to other parts of the world. But what's being overlooked in here, what is not getting the copy, is the very decent growth rate that is occurring in so many other economies around the world, and not least in the favorite Fuller Money themes of Asian progressing. I don't say developing or emerging markets anymore, the or not very often. The Asian progressing markets, the Middle Eastern progressing markets, the commodity exporting progressing markets from Russia to Brazil, Australia. But some of these markets, including Australia, have been affected by the credit crunch fears emanating from the USA, and there are have also been some there has also been some subprime contagion, and Australian banks, for instance, took a beating in January and remain near their lows, or actually extending those lows. But my point that I want to make is that I do feel that we've had a little bit of credit crunch myopia here, or actually, it hasn't been a little bit of credit crunch myopia. We've had a massive amount of credit crunch myopia. Understandable, you may say, well, this is the really biggest story of all. This is the worst thing that's happened since steroids in baseball or any other sport. Well, maybe. Maybe. But the banks aren't going to go bust at the end of the day. And you look at these stock markets, and there are not many bubbles remaining. There are a few high growth markets that are still pricey, such as China A shares, which most of us don't buy. And you could say, well, yes, India, if you've got a PE ratio of around 20, but a high growth market. Here, where you have the slower growth markets, we have, Owen pointed out the other day in that table that he produces every month, that lots of the European markets are selling at price earnings ratios, their indices, that is, of below 10%. So, and yields have been edging up. There's a lot of yield available. So, unless we're going to go into a global recession, This looks pretty good for a number of markets. Now, I see no chance of a global recession at this time. I don't see any reason why we should have a global recession. Is the US in recession? Well, I've said over and over again, you've got a two-tier economy there. The domestic economy is in the severest of recessions. The international economy, those multinational companies, are doing extremely well, earning good fees abroad, consolidating in them in weak US dollars. They're in a very competitive position. And so, as I say, they're doing extremely well. Now, we're also getting a lot of deleveraging, because as that stock market run and indeed boom from just starting from the ashes of that last bear market cycle, 2003, picking up speed, leverage increasing. Increasing steadily. Interest rates started to move up, leverage became more expensive for the most part. Then the credit crunch hit, and you know the rest of the story. People have been deleveraging ever since. That process is probably not over. I mean, heavens, I've been deleveraging recently. I was playing with a lot of leverage not that long ago, doing a little bit of my own mini plunge protection team in some of the stock markets, although not in the last couple of weeks here. In trading the precious metals, I'm out of those now for the time being. I have very few commodity positions, although I do have some longs in the industrial metals right now. So everybody's been deleveraging as there's been a lot of volatility, things have been fairly hairy, and there are all those fears that I've been talking about. Now that deleveraging process is putting downward pressure on some markets. It wasn't on the commodity markets because that was the one area where you could say we've got a positive momentum play. And that caused a lot of money to flow in that direction. Now, coming back to the stock markets, we have also had a lot of short selling, and banks, for instance, have not been shy about promoting the problems of the credit crunch in their research, putting out bearish forecasts on each other. I've been talking about this for a long time, short the shares, put out bearish forecasts. I mentioned when stock markets encountered resistance up near those February highs, stock markets and trading ranges, that's all the Europeans, the main US indices, once they encountered resistance up near those February highs, that was an invitation to bear traders who'd been squeezed following that selling climax on the 22nd of January. Once the February highs were rebuffing the rallies, then, as I said, that was an invitation for bear traders to come in. I even opened a short position in the DAX and then foolishly closed it because I hadn't timed it terribly brilliantly for about 12 hours. I should have stayed with it, but I digress. invitation to the short sellers who would very much like to push these stock markets through the January lows, triggering a little bit more selling pressure. They may or they may not. We had Wall Street and the European markets close soft in here today, and as I've said recently, and I'll emphasize again in this broadcast, for these lows to hold, it is for the bulls to prove. And I repeat that, for these lows to hold, it is for the bulls to prove. We have these stock market indices in medium-term downward trends, albeit they're still in ranging patterns, but they're testing the lower side of the range, having failed at the upper side of the range. And what is required is upward dynamics at these levels to signal to some of those short sellers and some of those reluctant buyers that some of these lows are going to hold and to trigger a rally. That's a big ask at the moment. But if it doesn't happen, if the short sellers succeed in breaking those January lows and keeping markets below, then that below those levels, then it does open the door to some additional selling pressure. But how much? Are things actually going to collapse? Well, they're already down a very, very long way. Those bank shares, my goodness, some of those are back at the levels that were seen in the last bear market. So they've unwound the entire run, obviously, that had occurred from that 2003 period onwards. And you might say quite right too, since the whole model on which they operate has broken down. And they haven't got a new model yet. They're recapitalizing, as I mentioned earlier on, through the yield curve with the aid of the central bankers. And they're doing one of the things that they do best, which is to speculate by selling short. And here, so that's the overall background. And my feeling is that we don't have all that much downside risk overall. What's all that much? A highly leveraged, I beg your pardon, a high beta market, these things are going to swing around. People say, who use conventional yardsticks on, well, I should put inverted commas around that, conventional yardsticks of 20% equals a bear market. Well, not in my book. 20% is a correction in my book. High beta emerging markets are going to swing in much bigger ranging patterns than that. If we were going to classify 20-30% in a high beta market, and that'll be everything from the mining shares to the best growth markets in the world, these Asian markets, Brazil. If we're going to classify, as I say, 20-30% as a bear market, then you're getting a bear market or two every year, and this is not this is not a sensible classification. Expect plenty of volatility. I think we're going to go on seeing that against an environment where we have some very obvious and emotive inflation pressures. But I get back to these stock markets overall. There certainly is value out there. Interest rates are coming down, albeit not as fast as they should have. US rates have come down a fair amount and they're going lower this month, but they should have been coming down much, much earlier. They should have been coming down in the summer, more in the summer and early autumn last year. And I do think that the ECB rates and the UK rates are too high. I think some of these other countries are in a position to cut rates, such as India, such as China, and they're of course being deterred from doing that by food prices. So a medium-term correction in food prices would, I think, do wonders in here. Will we see it? It's a good chance. There's a good chance that we will see that correction, but I think it's very much within a secular bull market. We're going to have this resources inflation with us now for a number of years. It will cause greater volatility. So what I've said here is that economically we've slowed the cycle and lengthened it. And then we have the, and so that will make it very difficult to get back into a 2003 to 2006 type of environment. Then we have this eyebrow raising, somewhat alarming agricultural price inflation, and that's going to contribute, it is contributing to more volatility, and it's going to continue to add to volatility in all markets. My own view is that the most vulnerable area right now is, in terms of medium term, most vulnerable area in terms of medium term, long-dated government bond markets, but not in the short term because of the recapitalizing effort that's taking place because of the fears for U.S. Economic growth and justified and the not so justified fears for global GDP growth generally. So my feeling is that for someone who was thinking of investing money for the long term, that stock markets are one heck of a lot better bet than the government bond markets. And I would also say that stock markets on a medium-term basis are a safer alternative to the commodity markets, agricultural commodity markets, where people have really kited prices higher. We've had those huge moves on the upside. I've been warning that this is going to become a social problem and that you would get the U.S. Government intervening at some stage if this continued. That immediate pressure may have abated if we get a medium-term correction in here right now in those markets, but I believe that the pressures will return. So again, emphasize that point. Even if these January lows are taken out on a closing basis for more than a day or two, and I said that that would open up the door to some further weakness in here, I feel that those January lows represent at worst the penultimate lows. In other words, the low before the final low. And I don't think the final low will be all that much lower. Those who've been on the chart seminar or those who have worked with charts for a number of years will know that you'll get a powerful trend up or down. And then that trend will begin to lose consistency near the end. And very often, if you don't get a parabolic acceleration, it will end with some churning action. It'll roll over, and you will then see, if it's an uptrend, you'll see it push up to a new high ground and following a big trading range after a long advance. And everybody thinks, oh, here we go again. But it doesn't go much further because all that ranging and following that long upward trend indicates that supply and demand are coming back into balance. But it doesn't come down quite enough to really frighten the bulls, and so they have one more go, but it doesn't get that much follow through. Same thing on the downside. You get a persistent downward trend, and then that trend begins to becomes climactic. You get a lot of two-way activity, but not enough on the upside to be able to deter the bear traders from one more go, and it breaks down again and goes a little bit lower, but then doesn't get all that much follow through and eventually rallies back up into the previous pattern. That occurs more often than not, that type of ending, that increased volatility, bigger trading range at the penultimate low and at the penultimate high. It's a very frequent pattern, and I think that's if those lows, those January lows don't hold, and they will hold for some markets, resources, I would say, for instance, where they don't hold, that they are the penultimate lows. Now, what about those bank shares? Well, still hitting new lows, and I've said for years, veteran subscribers will recall that in stock markets, what's good for the banks is good for the other sectors generally, and they continue to underperform. But look at some of those charts. Look at the weekly charts of individual banks. They are way, way oversold. So either UBS and Citigroup and some other top names are going to go bust, and the world's in a depression, or else this is an exaggerated sell-off. This is a bit overdone in here. Well, I certainly don't think they're going to go bust. And when financial banks are technically bust, and some of them certainly qualify, they get recapitalized through the yield curve, as I've mentioned on a number of occasions, including in this broadcast. So, also looking at the technical action on the banks, while they have still been soft, drifting down, they're not accelerating, and I don't think they will accelerate downwards again. So this looks very much like endgame to me. Does that mean that we're going to get really big advances here anytime soon? No. No, I'm very much in the long convalescence camp. Okay, moving on. I mentioned that government bonds on a medium-term basis, I think that's a vulnerable area. Medium-term, by my definition, for new subscribers is anything from a few months to a couple of years. But I think it's unlikely to be a convalescence of that length, although it could be. It could be. But look for at least a multi-month convalescence period of ranging. Now, that's not thrilling for investors. It's dull at best and it's stressful at worst, depending on the degree of volatility. You and I can only deal with the reality that markets provide. It's an environment in which you want to feel really relatively comfortable with your asset classification. Many of you know, because I tell people exactly what I do, I hold a lot of cash. I've tended to hold a lot of cash for quite some time. That's my just-in-case money, because I feel that I have enough money in equities. So I don't feel pressured, because I have the diversification, the trading activities, and most of you have seen what I've been doing in recent months. Holding on to my long-term core investment positions, some of which have been very solid, such as the golds in particular, but things like MLW and Rio Tinto, the ones that have been weakest by far, and they are my two biggest positions, but China situation, China market, China Atlantis China Fortune Fund, and any China fund, and much more recently, following a new high in January, JP Morgan India fund. Do I like seeing that down 20-30% or whatever it is? Of course not. But the fact that that was hitting a new high in January made me glad that I hadn't sold it back in August or September or whenever. And it also suggests to me that when confidence does return, that's going to be one of the first markets to push its way back up into new high ground, although probably not as quickly as the resources markets. I think people really do see the bull story there now. It's taken a long time for, I think, analysis to catch up with the screamingly bullish fundamentals that we've been talking about for the last 6 years in that sector. But to get back to activity, I think an investor who has most of their net wealth in equities, or let alone all of their net wealth in equities, is going to feel the heat more than people who have fairly diversified asset portfolio. I'm not talking about a diversified equity portfolio. I have one of the most undiversified equity portfolio. It's Asia and resources plays, but I have this cash, this just in case fund. Would I put that in stock markets at today's level? I don't feel any compunction to do so. I'm happy to have that earning a return. Currently, I just rolled that over again in New Zealand dollars at 8.22%. That just in case fund, if I have way underestimated the degree of panic that occurs in this stock market. And we know that markets, well, people describe stock markets as a discounting mechanism. That's true. But they're also an over discounting mechanism. So they go up much too high and they go down much too far. So if I have way underestimated the downside risk in these stock markets, and let's say we get a crash from here, that's not a forecast, it's a hypothesis, but if that were to happen, and anything can happen in markets, whether it's caused by what we know today or some exogenous event, but if that were to happen, then I would pull that cash out of the deposit account and put it to work in stock markets, because we would be getting one of those buys of a generation opportunities. At this level, I'm happy to sit with what I actually have. For those who wish to put money in fuller money themes, don't pay up. That's been kind of a mantra from Owen and myself for a long time. Don't pay up for these markets. And we say that to ourselves all the time when trading the precious metals. And when we pay up, we have cause usually to regret it in the short term, although not in the medium term, because they've been in upward trends. Well, I would I bought some more. I bought it in a leverage as a leverage trade. I bought some Rio, as you may recall, back right at the depth of the sell-off in January, and then traded it out after it had rallied back up to the upper side of the range. But I mentioned that just because that's the way. If you see in these strong themes, if you accept, if you agree with our view, I should say, of in terms of these strong secular themes, they will be subjected to some severe selling pressure from time to time. When you see it, that's the time that those who are interested in participating in those themes should be most keen to buy. It can be frightening at the time, of course, but you just look at long-term charts and you see what happens. Do you get bungee jumps on the downside? You bet you do. What happens after that? They usually go shooting up, back up to their highs, and eventually make new all-time highs. Currently, of the fuller money portfolio instruments, the ones that are depressed and looking interesting, well, there are three. There's the Indian investments, the China investments, and they're the funds I hold in those, but they're one spoiled for choice these days. There are lots of others in the library, and there's also a Cameco. I'm a little wary of Cameco because we've had such a good run in the mining shares, and that has underperformed. I'm glad I don't have a bigger position there. I have no intention of selling it. I'll probably add to it at some point, but not in here. Not in here today. People are too worried about the Cigar Lake project. That's understandable. But really, for people who are interested in India and China, they should be hoping for a bit further sell-off in here. But to put it this way, the more those markets fall in the short term, if they fall further in the short term, and they certainly would if the Wall Street leash effect drags is negative, then that would create, again, the further they fall, the better the buying opportunity for the medium to longer term recovery. But expect long convalescences for the banking sector and the Western markets, which means one doesn't have to be terribly aggressive in here. Don't need to go rushing in to these markets. And buying on weakness is best done in small bites. Okay, gotta move on, or this is gonna be, I don't want to break another record on audios if I haven't already. And I've talked about the bonds. Commodities, I've mentioned these weekly key reversals, and those were preceded by some daily key reversals in here this week. We had those big accelerations, always an ending of unknown duration, but the extent of the upside moves, the dynamics that we've seen in some of them, soybeans as an example, if you want to look at a few of these, suggests that we have commenced a medium-term correction. Owen hammered home that point in here today. I provided warnings earlier in the week, and not least in that copy that I produced on Wednesday, I believe. And precious metals. Now, platinum. It's been the upside leader all along. Big upward acceleration. Fell $175 in here today. That really does scream medium-term correction in platinum. So that's adding further evidence that to my hypothesis that this was a maturing stage of the medium-term upward move in these metals. Something Owen mentioned today also in his copy, it hasn't been posted yet. I'll get to that, complete my own copy, and then and post that later on this evening. Said that gold was the one that hadn't accelerated. Platinum accelerated the most, silver accelerated, although not quite so much as some of its previous upward moves. So there's possibility that that has one further go. I don't think platinum can have another go on the upside, although it could rally back up and get some right-hand extension in a medium-term top. And but gold has the most orderly of those trends, so it's certainly not beyond the bounds of possibility that gold gets another run in here over the next few weeks. But the message here is that the risk factor is rising for this sector on a medium-term basis. Do I still like it on a longer-term basis? You bet I do. But medium-term, it's too hot. The industrial metals, I think, particularly some of the depressed industrial metals, are more interesting on a medium-term basis. And they've been far less fashionable, whereas everybody's had a go at the precious metals. And crude oil, awfully steady in here. If this were to come back below $198, it would begin to look like an upside failure. US dollar, last but not least. Mind you, gold, beg your pardon, oil is very much in a secular bull market in here. I'm just talking about when I talked about if it came below 198, that would suggest to me that we were, well, that would begin to indicate an upside failure in terms of this latest breakout to 106, and we could expect more ranging activity, but it hasn't done that. Of course, it's broken out on the upside and remains very strong. So we may be above $100 for really quite some time. If you ask me where oil's going to be a couple of years from now, 2, 3, 4 years from now, I think it'll be well above $100. Secular bull market. Supply and elasticity meets rising demand. We have the supply and elasticity because either the producers can't produce or won't produce. And the demand is rising remorselessly. U.S. economy in recession. It's going to be, in terms of the two consecutive quarters of negative GDP, if it doesn't achieve that, it's a bit of a moot point here because the domestic economy is in severe recession, as I mentioned earlier in this broadcast. Crude oil, global consumption of crude oil will rise by at least 2 million barrels a day. This year, I think it's up around 87 million barrels a day, or maybe more, a little bit more. It's very, very strong. So it's just moving remorselessly upwards. Something I've mentioned many occasions before, but not for quite some time. crude oil, the global consumption of crude oil was rising throughout that entire 2001-2002 recession. The rate just slowed a little bit, but it was still rising. So again, secular bull market here. Now, what about the US dollar? It's fallen for a month, and it had a somewhat better close in here today. We're seeing some sharp reactions in commodity markets. I think people who've driven short-term trends too far are going to be booking some profits. That suggests to me that we may have s might just have seen a low in the dollar index here today, to be followed by a little bit of a technical rally. But what's it going to do? It got down to 72.46. Maybe it gets up to 73.46, maybe 74. But I don't think much more than that. And I've said something I've said the last couple of years, at least, that I felt that we probably wouldn't see the end of the dollar's decline until shortly after we had multilateral intervention. Very rare. It's occurred maybe half a dozen times, not more than eight, surely, since the end of Bretton Woods in 1971, when from which point we've had free floating. Currencies an entirely fiat, I beg your pardon, we've had an entirely fiat currency world, paper money, since the breakup of Bretton Woods. And I think that, as I've said, that it'll take multilateral intervention to put a sustainable floor under the dollar, and central banks only do that when it is absolutely, well, anywhere, when they feel that a continuation of an existing trend is clearly detrimental to their national interests. They're ambivalent today. Manufacturers, exporters in Euroland do not like the strength of the euro. Obviously, it's eating into their profits. But the central bank can also say, yes, but this is helping to keep import prices down, and therefore it acts as a restraint on inflation, and so they'll accept it. Also, the U.S. economy is not as critical for them as it was previously. The U.S. economy isn't critical for any part of the world as much as it was previously. It's still very important, obviously, but I've said before, we're moving rapidly from what was a unipolar world to a multipolar world, for which the engine of growth, so long the USA, is now clearly Asia. And I think that's pretty much it. What currencies will do best? The ones that are being jawboned least, in other words, where central banks are not trying to too hard to reverse the trend. The most, as we've seen recently with the Asian currencies, they try to hold it up. But I beg your pardon, with the some of the resources currencies, some of the resources currencies, central banks in those countries have tried to stem those gains. We've seen that before with the New Zealand dollar. We've seen it before with the Australian dollar. The most undervalued currencies in the world are Asian. And that's it, folks. Sorry about the length of this audio and the croaking voice, but I did get through the broadcast. Have a great weekend. I'm sure you need the rest. I do too. Meanwhile, all the very best to all of you.